You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Kamara-Sami with NewsHour. A huge natural disaster in a country at the centre of global security concerns. The floodwaters which have swept through Pakistan, causing death for thousands and upheaval for millions, were always going to have ripples far beyond the country's borders. But the extent of the devastation, coupled with the sluggish international response to appeals for aid, have raised concerns about Pakistan's prospects for recovery in the short or even the medium term, and have prompted unsettling questions about how the rest of the world perceives the country. And now it's prompted the UN General Assembly to hold a special session in New York to consider the global response to the crisis. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said that the disaster was a key test of global solidarity. And Pakistan's Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi spoke of the scale of the disaster.
I stand before you as the voice of 20 million Pakistanis devastated by floods, who have lost their homes and hearths, their kith and kin, their lives and their livelihoods. 1 in 10 Pakistanis has been rendered destitute. 20% of our land is submerged in water. Ours is primarily an agrarian economy. 70% of our population is employed in the agriculture sector. And this is where we have been hit the most.
Well, that was the Pakistan Foreign Minister. And I think we can hear Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, the U.S. Secretary of State, talking at the moment.
We demonstrated that commitment with a multi-year $7.5 billion non-military assistance package authorized by the Congress and agreed to by the President. We will now take some of those funds that were directed to initiatives that I announced just last month in Islamabad to support Pakistan in its reconstruction efforts. In all of our work, we are seeking to strengthen Pakistan's democratic institutions.
Well, listening to that at the UN is our State Department correspondent, Kim Khatas. Kimva, some very strong words we've been hearing.
Very strong words from all sides, really. We've heard from Hillary Clinton, who acknowledged that the response from the international community has really paled against the magnitude of the challenge. We heard from Ban Ki-moon, who described the floods as a slow-motion tsunami. Very evocative, really, because everybody remembers the pictures of that natural disaster. And what this session at the UN is trying to do is try to build a sense of urgency, trying to appeal to people to give more money. Because even if the death toll is relatively low, every death is a tragedy, of course, the impact on Pakistan is devastating and will be long-lasting. But perhaps the strongest words that we heard from this session so far were from the Pakistani foreign minister, who said that this crisis cannot be allowed to be turned into an opportunity for the terrorists, as he called them. And he said that Pakistan did not want to lose the gains that it had gotten in a very hard war against militants.
But this is not a donor conference as such. This is not an appeal. This is the global community coming together and making a statement, really.
Absolutely. This is the international community, the UN, the US, the Pakistanis coming together, appealing to the international community to understand, to come to grasp what it is really going to mean for Pakistan. No country here is really pledging more money, although there are some countries like the United States that are highlighting how much money they've already given, how much money they will be giving. But this is really, in a way, a symbolic session. It is about sensitizing the international community. It's about building a sense of urgency and trying to get more involvement from the international community, more money, particularly from Muslim countries, for example, which have not given that much so far.
Kim Khatas at the United Nations. Thanks very much. Well, my colleague Lise Doucette has been in Pakistan since the floods first struck 3 weeks ago, and she's been tirelessly monitoring the situation on the ground.
Thousands of miles away from New York, this is a country in waiting, waiting for more aid to arrive and hoping that UN meeting makes a difference before it's too late. And as we speak, the Indus River, bloated to terrifying proportions, is still wreaking havoc. It's a race against time as officials in Sindh province in the south make what are truly life and death decisions. Which villages should be saved? Where to divert floodwaters to save power stations or military bases? It all began 3 weeks ago on the other side of Pakistan in the northwest. I happened to be there as the worst monsoon rains on record started falling. And now, in the searing heat, the floodwaters are starting to recede, revealing the extent of destruction. And the relief effort is gathering pace. So I went to visit one distribution centre in Chamkani, organised by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the UNHCR. And here in this warehouse in the city of Peshawar, you can hear the sound of plastic buckets. They're being stacked here, and then they're going to be filled with goods for some of the displaced people who are queuing up outside the door. Bashir Ahmed is here.
Yep.
You're the regional coordinator now for the UNHCR.
Yes.
Now tell us what's going to be put into these plastic buckets.
These plastic buckets are mainly meant for storing portable drinking water. And it's part of the bigger non-food package, which include plastic sheets, plastic mats, sleeping mats, mosquito nets, and kitchen utensils. That is two buckets per family.
And so this is what you consider is their essential items for them to start putting together a home after they've lost everything.
Yes, I think these are the very basic, because some of the people, they have virtually lost everything. They don't have a pot to store water for drinking. And I think this is very basic, very, very important for them to store some water for drinking at least.
And what about shelter? They'll use the plastic sheeting or will they be given tents?
We are giving tents, and along with the tents, two plastic sheets and some flooring material to those people who have completely lost their houses. And there are many. The number is huge. I mean, the number is very huge.
Really huge, says the UNHCR's Bashir Ahmed. And this northern province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, near the tribal agencies along the Afghan border, is, as he mentioned, also home to many Afghan refugees. Some of their camps have been here since the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, and they haven't looked like camps for many years. They're sprawling towns of mud brick homes. One camp, Azakhel, on the banks of the Kabul and the Swat rivers, was flattened by the floods. So now that the waters have receded, we were able to visit. And there I met two of the more than 30,000 Afghans in Azakhel who lost everything. Here are two young boys in blue shalwar kameez. Their tunic and trousers that are worn here are a bit grubby, but you would expect this. They've lost their homes, and behind us we can see all that's left of the camp that they used to live in. What's your name?
My name is Abdul Sabur.
And how old are you, Abdul Sabur?
I am 8.
And what about you?
My name is Muhammad Nasir.
And how old are you?
I'm 12 years old.
Where were you?
I'm at home.
And what happened when the water came?
Like from the 3 weeks ago, there was raining for all night. In the morning, the flood came and we left our house with my uncle and his son. We went to his house and one of our uncle left at home to see what the belonging he can save.
What is left of your house? Your house is here?
Yeah, this is my home.
This is your house?
Yeah.
All that's left is some bricks and mud and sticks. And did you lose everything?
We were the happiest family because we saved a very small number of our household, some luggage, and something like that, because we try to go out of the camp at the earliest.
What did you save that you really like? Did you save some books or some toys?
I left my school certificates, my books, my uniform, everything, my belongings, my toys, everything I belong, it's just left here.
And Lise Doucette, they're speaking to some Afghan refugees. And you can see pictures of the boys there on the News Hour Facebook page. Well, as Lise was mentioning, it's the other end of the country that's now bearing the brunt of the flooding. It's been hard to reach the worst affected areas in Punjab province and Sindh, where the UN now estimates 4 million people have been left homeless. But a team from the International Committee of the Red Cross has managed to get access. The head of the ICRC mission in Pakistan, Pascal Kuta, told me what they'd found.
You have the water still rising. Hundreds of thousands of people are still on the move. Some are trying to go back to salvage what they can. Others are coming out. Absolute chaos on the roads, which are underwater. And all of that in very dirty water, without access to clean water, with very little in terms of healthcare, and with the food being slowly brought in because it's such an unbelievable magnitude.
Where do the aid agencies start?
What we are trying to do is to identify the worst hit areas, but in a disaster which is still evolving, that's not always easy.
Yes, so I was going to ask you, how are you going about that?
The Pakistani Red Crescent has 130,000 volunteers working throughout the country. That sounds like very much and very many, and indeed it is, but one has to remember the size of the country and the size of the disaster. So these people are feeding permanently back from the ground, and this allows us to make decisions with regard to priorities.
What about actual aid itself? The UN says that it's starting to get somewhere near the figures that it has requested in the initial emergency aid, but is there much evidence of that getting through?
The emergency aid is coming in. Food is coming in, shelter is coming in. We have so far reached 200,000 people in terms of food, 150,000 in terms of shelter. Given the numbers, though, of those who are in need of aid, while this is very much what we are already bringing in, it is not standing the comparison to the needs.
How well is it all being coordinated, as far as you can tell?
Coordination is starting to kick in a way which I would personally consider to be satisfactory, especially in Islamabad. However, in the south, in Punjab and Sindh, such coordination mechanisms have so far not been in place. They're in the process of being built up. The primary necessity at this stage is to collectively identify priority issues and priority areas.
At this point, you can already say that there will be, what, tens, hundreds of thousands of people who need help, who you can say now won't be getting it?
Yes, and rather hundreds of thousands, if not millions, just because of the size of what is happening and because of the collective capacity of humanitarian organizations and government, it is becoming clear that there will be hundreds of thousands at least who will have simply to take care of themselves, and that's very frustrating.
What can the international community do? What can be decided at this UN special meeting in New York that could help the situation?
To allocate as much resources and to organise that these resources are properly used as possible.
Quantity, is that the important thing?
Quantity, but there is also an issue of logistics. There's simply an issue of access. There will remain bottlenecks. We're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of truckloads of food, of shelter, which in the emergency phase need to be deployed. We have 350 trucks running every day, and that's just a part of the overall effort. We must, all of us, do as much as we can. My fear is that it won't be enough.
And that was Pascal Coutard, the head of the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross Mission in Pakistan, on the situation in the south of the country. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming up later in the programme, why South Africa's public sector workers like this teacher are refusing to back down on the question of pay.
I'm worth more. Inflation aside, I'm worth more in terms of the input, the output, the nurturing of the child. It's important that I be paid better, that I be paid well. It is crucial. Education drives the economy.
We'll have more on that later on in the programme, but first a reminder of our main world news at this hour. The United Nations Secretary General has made an appeal for more help for Pakistan at a special meeting of the General Assembly, saying it was facing a slow-motion tsunami. An announcement about direct peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians is expected to be made in Washington in the next 48 hours. And the world's largest electronics manufacturer, Foxconn of Taiwan, has said it plans to create 400,000 new jobs in China. Now it's time for another song in our series, Striking a Chord. Some of the biggest names in world music have been talking exclusively to NewsHour about the songs they wrote which struck a chord with a generation, a group or a nation. Today it's the turn of Zaib and Hania, or to give them their full names, Zaibu Nisa Bungash and Hania Aslam. They're a female duo from Pakistan's northwest frontier province, and they're also cousins. They're ethnically Pathan, although they've lived all over Pakistan and mostly sing in Urdu. Their debut single, Chup, became famous via the internet and then radio play, whilst the girls were away studying in the United States. When they returned to Pakistan for a holiday, they found the song that they'd recorded for fun had struck a chord with Pakistani youth, and they'd become the toast of radio shows right across South Asia.
Sunte sunte mera sabr to khatm hua bas baatein bahut hui ab to pyar ka waqt hua.
It means hush, I'm running out of patience just listening, stop, that's enough talk, it's time for love now.
Chup sunte sunte mera sabr to khatm hua bas baatein bahut hui.
The word chup is an Urdu word and it literally means quiet.
Hush.
Or hush, and it can be used aggressively also if you want to tell someone to be quiet.
I mean, you hear it a lot when you're kids because, you know, when you're creating a ruckus or you're talking when you're not supposed to, someone's always be like, chup, chup karo, you know, be quiet.
There's always this thing of women talking a lot and they never shut up and all of that. This song is sort of a reverse take on that, and it's telling... It's basically telling this man who thinks a lot of himself and who keeps talking and sort of loves to hear his own voice. It tells him to stay quiet for a minute and sort of move on to other things. The story behind the song is that we were both in college. It was fall break or Thanksgiving break, and in New England it gets really, really cold at that time, and I think there was a blizzard, and Zaib was in a rural campus at that time and everything had shut down and we had nowhere to go, and I think we were short of food, and so we were just looking for something to eat. We went to the basement of her dorm to look for vending machines, and we found this abandoned bookstore / coffee shop. And it was just really bizarre, and there were all these tables with chairs overturned and a whole bar set up and shelves with books in them and coffee cups and cobwebs. So I don't know why we thought we'd bring the guitar down and just sit there and jam. And I used to play all this very spooky stuff at that time, so we just spooked ourselves out. So Zaib said, no, play something happy. So I just played this riff, and then she went, chup! And the song just evolved from that. Zaib's sister, Maliha, wrote quite a lot of the lyrics for the song for us.
And since it was our first song together, it kept getting evolved.
To tell you the truth, we were surprised that a song came out of it. Sitting in that basement, we were just having fun and we thought it, you know, we'd have a laugh, and every time we'd play it for someone and they'd be like, oh, that's a great song. And I mean, that's actually what snowballed, and every time somebody said that's a great song, we'd move a step further with it.
So we recorded this song in front of a screen like that, and then she put it up on her website because she was a computer science major, so she used to love making websites. And someone from back home found it on the internet, and when we came back for our holidays in the summer, we found it being played on the radio. So that was a surprise. And then finally, we had a friend who was a producer, so we went and made him listen to it. And we were surprised to find out that he kind of shoved us into the recording booth and said, record this. And we did a rough demo of it, again, a little bit confused. And
he played
bass over it, and then he gave us a cassette. And that version started going on the internet.
And before we knew it, I mean, it would literally be like we would wake up one morning and my mother would be like, you guys are in the papers. And we'd open the newspaper and be some journalist who'd written, come out with your album already.
The Chook
we love
Girls.
Chook. So we started being known as the Chook Girls. And I think that really encouraged us. So we just started writing more and more songs. And Hania especially came up with quite a few songs. And then one fine day we decided to make an album.
Initially, I think the people who were listening to it was the Pakistani student body in the US. No, I think people liked the fact that it was a different voice coming from Pakistani women. It was more confident, it was more assertive, yeah, you know, it wasn't shy or coy. And because in South Asia, I think a lot of love is about unconsummated love. It's about longing, it's about just sort of pining.
So this suggestion.
So this song isn't pining at all. Later we found, I mean, there was all sorts of, you know, there's been political crises in this country, and apparently there were talk shows on radio and television which were using the song to talk to politicians.
Yeah, that's been the most wonderful thing, is I think we've recognized that when you put a work out there, then, you know, people can own it in their own ways, and then they do so many more creative things with it, and that's really exciting.
And one more sort of fan base we have because of this song. We have been getting a lot of emails from parents of very young children. And babies, sort of infants and toddlers, apparently love this song because, A, like Zeb said, Chup is a word very, very familiar to young children. I mean, I think it's one of the first words you hear because you're crying and then you're told to keep quiet. And also it's a song that, you know, stops and starts and stops and starts, and it's very dynamic that way. And apparently babies love this song, and that's one of the most exciting things for me.
Chup, just as well she warned us about the stop starting, or I could have spoiled the enjoyment of the last 10 seconds for you there. Anyway, that was a Pakistani songwriting cousins, Zeb and Hania. They were talking to NewsHour's Emma Wallace, and we'll be featuring another in our series, Striking a Chord, in tomorrow's programme, when the man they call the Russian Bob Dylan, Boris Grebenshikov, will be talking about holding true to his musical ideals whilst facing the disapproval of the Soviet authorities. Now, you can find all the songs in the series on our website. Just go to bbcworldservice.com/news and click on Striking a Chord. We've already got interviews there with Tracy Chapman, Femi Kuti and the Somali rapper Kanan. You'll find each day's new song there as you go along. We also want your suggestions for songs that have struck a chord with you, perhaps one that's helped you get through a particular time in your life. This is a suggestion from Polina Malamud. She said, well, since you mentioned that you're going to have Boris Grebenshikov, I thought I'd include a Russian song in this list. The band is Mashina Vremeni, Time Machine. The song Kastyor Campfire never fails to bring tears to my eyes. James Doherty has posted the song that hits home for him is Ohio by Crosby, Stills and Nash. It's about the senseless shooting at Kent State University in May 1970 during some Vietnam War protests. Do let us know what struck a chord with you. You can go onto our Facebook page, BBC NewsHour. Email us, worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com, or send us a text. The number is 4477 86 2060. I'm James Kamara-Sami. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm James Kamara-Sami with NewsHour. Now, whether or not it is mission accomplished, the US combat mission in Iraq is over. 2 weeks ahead of President Obama's deadline, troops from the 4th Stryker Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division, rolled in convoy across the Iraqi border and into Kuwait in the early hours of Thursday morning, more than 7 years after American troops first entered the country in March 2003.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war.
I can see more or less every single building is in flames. There was another series of thumps just then. What looks like the oil refinery to the south has gone up and ball of flame.
We're still encountering some light resistance, but we do have troops in the center of Baghdad now. Coalition forces have entered the city.
My emotions, I don't really have any right now, maybe later on. I think the emotions of the people are more important right now.
We do believe that this is the beginning of the end. We're by no means finished here. We just need to get back on the road and finish our jobs. That way we can all go home.
Well, some voices over the last 7 years. Now, Nabil Salim lives in Baghdad. For him, the occupation of foreign forces in Iraq has done more harm than good.
We're looking for change, but not for occupying. The change that comes through occupying, nobody wanted. Maybe the only thing they do it as an occupied power is ending the regime of Saddam Hussein. And as I think, they destroyed everything in this country, the history, economy, the factories, they invaded the people, the army, everything.
Well, that was one man's view, that essentially it was good to topple Saddam Hussein, but a lot of destruction otherwise. But what do the facts and figures tell us about how life for Iraqis has changed in the 7 years since US troops entered the country? Well, Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington and author of the Iraq Index, which has been tracking a whole range of statistics about the country since 2003. How do you see things, Michael O'Hanlon, looking at it empirically? Has the current situation in Iraq compare well with before the invasion?
It's getting better, although I can't really disagree or say it any better than your previous guest, the Iraqi citizen. Certainly the immediate aftermath and the following 4 to 5 years were, as we all know, extremely turbulent and violent, and it would be hard to make the case that those 4 or 5 years were better for the typical Iraqi than the, let's say, 4 or 5 years that preceded it. Certainly the 1980s were the worst of all periods for modern Iraq, when Saddam launched the war against Iran, massacred the Kurds, and then after Operation Desert Storm, when he massacred so many Shia, and probably had a million persons' blood on his hands. But the 1990s, as we all maintained the containment regime, especially U.S. and U.K. forces, sort of kept him a little more restrained. And while he was trying to break out of those sanctions and that containment with time, probably the average Iraqi's life was a bit more stable.
And over the last, over the last 7 years, though, in terms of the standard of living, the access to power, to all the basic needs of human life, how have things changed for Iraqis?
Right. Well, there hasn't been, until the last year or two, much progress, which is part of why I focused on, I thought, what was the most central important point to make in initially responding to your question, that political violence was the overwhelmingly important variable in terms of what changed from the 1990s or early part of the following decade until 2003 and its aftermath. That was where you saw the big change. Iraq became a much more violent place. It became slightly more economically vibrant, certainly much more politically free, but far more violent. And only in the last couple of years would I say that Iraq has begun to emerge and begun to reach a point where you could compare favorably current quality of life conditions for the average Iraqi to what had occurred under Saddam Hussein. I do think life now for the average Iraqi is better than, let's say, in the 1990s. It's certainly far better than it was in the 1980s, as I just mentioned. But if you look at things like electricity, the overall amount of electricity production is now perhaps 50% greater than it had been under Saddam. So that's notable progress. Educational institutions are probably returning to their previous levels. I'm not sure they really have surpassed them, except in those areas of political expression where obviously there was a great deal of suppression under Saddam. So depending on the indicator, you're going to see more or less progress. But things are a little better now than they had been under Saddam, but it took a long time to get here.
Okay, Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution, thank you very much for that. Well, joining me now from Washington is Zalmay Khalilzad. He served for 2 years as the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, and he's also a former U.S. envoy to Afghanistan and to the United Nations. Ambassador, do you believe this is mission accomplished?
No, this is progress, a significant progress. But ultimately, the judgment on Iraq would have to be made if and when the new order consolidates economic life for Iraqis improve. And for that, we still have to wait for some time.
Do you think this was the right time to pull out combat troops?
I think so. It seems that the Iraqi institutions, security institutions, are strong enough to be able to handle the current situation. I think the concern is more if there is a total withdrawal at the end of next year, whether Iraq would be ready to take over overall responsibility by itself at that time.
President Obama seems committed to that, though.
He is, and it's appropriate for him to say that. But as you...
Because this was an agreement, of course, drawn up under President Bush, wasn't
exactly. it? Exactly. But I think the Iraqis and some in the United States have began to discuss the wisdom of actually going ahead with that, and given the likely situation in which Iraq would not be in a position to protect itself against both internal and external dangers at the end of next year. And so the Secretary of Defense here has indicated an openness to perhaps adjusting that timeline. And some Iraqi leaders, similarly security leaders, have spoken about this. So I would not personally be surprised if, based on an Iraqi request, and we will have to see when the new government is formed what kind of government it will be, that based on a request from Iraq, that timeline will be adjusted.
It's been a long time, 1998, since you signed that letter with a number of other people to President Clinton calling for the ouster of Saddam Hussein. Any regrets about the way things have panned out since then?
Sure. It has been a lot harder, more difficult for the Iraqis and for us than one would have anticipated. And of course, regret the loss of civilian life, particularly Iraqis, large numbers of whom have suffered. But I think we have given the Iraqis an opportunity for a much better life, to live in a democratic order, and to realize the huge economic potential that they have.
Was that at the expense, though, of the Afghans and what is happening in Afghanistan? Did you take your eye off the ball?
Well, as you know, I was the ambassador to Afghanistan before moving to Iraq. I think Afghanistan did suffer to an extent, although I think one exaggerates it at times, because in the aftermath of Iraq, we did increase our reconstruction assistance to Afghanistan. And Afghanistan was doing well for the first 2-3 years after we were in Iraq. But I'm sure more attention could have been paid to Afghanistan had we not gone to Iraq. But I think success in both are important for the broader requirement that the world has, the transformation of this region, which produces so many problems for the world.
Zalmay Khalilzad, thank you very much. We have to leave it there. Now, the Israelis and the Palestinians have been holding indirect talks for several months now with the help of the US envoy George Mitchell. But now the BBC has learned that the US State Department is about to take the important symbolic step of relaunching direct talks between the two sides, the first substantive discussions of their kind for 9 years. It's expected to make an announcement about the terms and timetable for those talks within the next few days. But speaking earlier, a spokesman for the US State Department, PJ Crowley, told journalists that the details were still being worked out.
There's work being done today. I know there's been some conjecture that we're poised to make a statement. We think we're very, very close, but there's still work being done, and there are details being worked out.
Well, the BBC's correspondent in Jerusalem, Wira Davis, has been looking into the story. Will the announcement, when it does happen, be an invitation to talks or a guarantee that they'll actually be starting?
I think it's much more than an invitation, because the invitation has been out there for quite a while. What this statement, if it comes, or when it comes in the next 48 hours from the State Department, will be, I understand, a timetable and some ground rules for direct peace talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Of course, they've been involved in indirect talks through ex-Senator George Mitchell for quite a while now, and there's been a lot of pressure, particularly on the Palestinians, from the Obama administration to move on to the next stage and take advantage of what everybody sees as a very small window to engage in peace talks directly, although, of course, there is no guarantee of success.
Now, the Israelis have been very keen to stress they don't want any preconditions. And there has been a suggestion that having any kind of agenda would be preconditioned. So has that been overcome then, do we understand?
I think more pressure has been put on the Palestinians than the Israelis. The Palestinians feel they've got their fingers burnt before, and they wanted some ground rules established as a basis for talks. For example, that a future Palestinian state should be based on the 1967 ceasefire lines, and that any controversial building in illegal Jewish settlements should be stopped before any talks resume. And I think the Palestinians wanted these ground rules as a sort of a guarantor as to where the boundaries lay. The Israelis didn't want that. They said, no, let's go in with a clean slate. So you could look at it and say perhaps the Israelis appear to have got their way here. And there is certainly a lot of opposition on the Palestinian street, a lot of suspicion, not just in Gaza, of course, where Hamas are totally opposed to these talks, but even in places like Ramallah and the West Bank, that there's a feeling that the Palestinians are perhaps giving up too much even before they go to the talks.
Wira Davis there. Now, what does a rhinoceros have in common with a pineapple? Give up? Well, they're both proposed shapes of cities in southern Sudan. The government there has plans to design the regional capital Juba in the shape of a rhinoceros, stretch the town of Wau into the form of a giraffe, and turn the town of Yambio into a pineapple. Well, the BBC's Peter Martel is in southern Sudan, and he described what the giraffe-shaped city could contain.
There's a golf course involved in it. The long legs are the housing, and that reaches up to the belly, which is going to be the city centre hall. And then going up into the neck, there's more residential until the head. The head is going to be where the local government is, and also where the soldiers, the police. The industrial area is the rump of the animal, and then the long tail reaches out, and that's actually the pipes for the effluent from the sewage work is the tail of the animal. The ministry have asked for around $10 billion. They're asking for private tenders. I mean, South Sudan does have oil, but certainly nothing on the scale of that. And although they say this is going to be a 20-year or 20-year-plus plan, well, it's ambitious to say the least.
The BBC's Peter Martel there. Well, ambition aside, can a city function if shaped like a rhinoceros? Well, Michael Sorkin is director of the graduate programme in urban design at City College in New York.
The meaning of the morphologies, this is something that is a little bit perplexing, but charming withal, and certainly is situated in a long history of cities that have shapes. In the European example, you know, half the cities in the Renaissance were designed as ideal geometrical shapes. So these are a little more pictorial and figurative, but still part of the same impetus to make cities distinctive. I think the real questions that one needs to ask are first, whether these cities are necessary, and I think the answer to that is obvious, but then whether they are sustainable.
Well, on the assumption that they will go ahead with these plans, talk about geometrical shapes, but a giraffe?
The shape may be viable, it may not, depending on how the functions are distributed, how the neighborhoods are laid out, and what the actual size of the thing.
And what about the idea of doing something that is clearly an attention-grabbing thing to design a city in these interesting shapes? Is that a wise way of attracting money, attracting designers?
I'd say that there's another reason for doing this kind of figurative planning, and that is the recognition of the fact that cities around the world are growing more and more the same. You know, you go from London to Beijing, you find the same McDonald's and the same Starbucks and the same H&M, and we are plagued by a kind of multinational sameness in our cities. And obviously one of the antidotes to this relentless, remorseless sameness is the injection of an artistic sensibility in the design of the city. And one of the things I noticed is that I think the rhinoceros is only meant to be the center of the city. So what's the difference between Trafalgar Square, a square, Piccadilly Circus, a circle, and the Sudanese rhinoceros? It's figural, it's recognizable. If it's functional, let's have it.
If you're looking at the city like this from an aerial view, it will have a certain impact. But for somebody living in a city, does the shape of it matter? If you're living in a city that's shaped like a rhinoceros or a pineapple or a giraffe, does that have an impact on your life as a city dweller?
Imagine yourself a school child who joins his or her mates and says, let us trace the outline of the rhinoceros. This sounds like it could be a delightful thing. Ah, now we're at the horn. Now we're at the mouth. You know, now we're at the tail. You know, I think you need to lighten up a little bit in terms of the dead orthodoxy of a regular planning arrangement in cities. You know, there's been a lot of talk lately about the Bilbao effect, you know, this wild and crazy building that somehow put a derelict Spanish industrial town on the map. Maybe people will speak about the rhinoceros effect in the future. You know, if this enables them to build a decent, sustainable city for people who desperately need it, I say more power to them.
And that was Michael Sorkin, director of the graduate program in urban design at City College in New York, talking about the plan in southern Sudan to have some cities shaped like animals. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Now, a reminder of today's main news. The United Nations Secretary General has made an appeal for more help for Pakistan at a special meeting of the General Assembly, saying the country was facing a slow-motion tsunami. The US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, told the General Assembly that the United States is standing with Pakistan.
I want the people of Pakistan to know that the United States will stand with you during this crisis. We will be with you as rivers rise and fall. We will be with you as you replant your fields and repair your roads. We will be with you as you meet the long-term challenges to build a stronger nation and a better future.
That was U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking at the UN General Assembly. Now, in South Africa, the army has been called in to protect hospitals from striking public sector workers. It's the second day of a national strike, and unions with a membership of over a million people say that they've brought many services to a standstill. Rubber bullets have been fired at a number of locations as the strikers try to block roads and target people going to work. From Soweto, here's our correspondent, Jonah Fisher.
I'm now outside the Chris Hani Baragwanath Hospital in Soweto. It's one of the biggest hospitals in the world, and a group of several hundred protesters have blocked the main entrance, stopping anyone coming in and out of the hospital.
What is our dignity as government workers? That means the minister and his team, they don't care about government workers, the civil servants.
And how long are you prepared to go on strike for?
As long as it takes. This is an indefinite strike.
Then, having seen many hospital employees ignore the picket line, the strikers lost patience. Nurses in maternity wards were dragged out before the police fired rubber bullets to try and restore order. With the blessing of government, the hospital's chief executive, Joanna Mori, called in the army.
Now at about 1:15, the South African Defence Forces arrive, you know, security services. They will be manning our gates and patrolling the grounds, you know, just to make sure that we don't have these elements any longer.
As the day progressed, more reports of violence came in from across South Africa as striking workers tried to prevent other government-run institutions like schools and courts functioning. In southern Johannesburg, there was another flashpoint as the police tried to stop teachers blocking a road. Why are you worth 8.6% when inflation is about 4%?
I'm worth more. Inflation aside, I'm worth more in terms of the input, the output, the nurturing of the child. It's important that I be paid better, that I be paid well. It is crucial. Education drives the economy.
Are you worried that the classrooms are empty today?
Yes, I am worried. I'm very, very worried. But doesn't mean I must be worried at the expense of my own well-being.
For South Africa's President Jacob Zuma, it's a difficult moment. Faced with violence and anger from the trade unions, people he'd traditionally consider his most loyal supporters.
We respect the rights of workers to strike, but also people, for an example, who don't want to strike, or kids that want to go to school, and people who are... Or doctors want to go to hospitals, they must not be interfered with.
But the government's position appears to be hardening. It says it can't pay more than 7% without cutting elsewhere, and it's planning to implement the wage increase, whether the unions agree or not.
This is Fikile Majola from one of the health workers' unions, Nehawu.
It's a very dangerous statement, extremely dangerous. I don't know why cabinet is doing this. They have essentially closed down the negotiations.
So the strikes look set to continue, and as frustration grows, there are likely to be more violent clashes around hospitals and schools.
And that was Jonah Fisher reporting. Location, location, location. Until now, that's been the mantra associated with judging the best value property. But now it's gaining prominence in the world of social networking. From today, Facebook users in the United States will be able to tell their Facebook friends exactly where they are, thanks to a new geolocation service called Facebook Places. Well, to discuss the implications of all this, I have with me here in the studio Sue Charman-Anderson, a social media consultant. So this is not the only geolocation-based social networking, is it? But just if you can explain how it works in general.
So with Facebook Places, Facebook users will be able to check into a location, say a cafe or a bar, and they'll be able to upload comments and photographs about that location. They'll also be able to check in their friends as well, so they'll be able to say who they're there with. Now, this is only working in some locations.
Just like tagging a photo, almost.
Yeah, a bit like tagging a photo, yeah, but there's a little bit more information in that than just this was this person in this photo. But it's only available at the moment in certain parts of America, so it'll be rolling out across the US in weeks to come and then eventually probably around the rest of the world.
Is this something that people will have to opt into? There's always these questions, aren't there, when you get new things like this about privacy. Will you have to opt into this or opt out of it?
So the Facebook privacy settings will allow users to decide whether or not they want to take part in Facebook Places, whether they want to share their location information. But like a lot of Facebook settings, it's actually quite complicated. It's not just one button that you turn off and that's it done. You actually have to be quite careful to make sure that you've opted out, not just on your own behalf, but also that you have opted out letting your friends tag you at a location.
On a sort of wider term, it does seem, though, that the internet, which started off as being something very anonymous, now it's turning into the opposite almost, isn't it? You can't hide away. You're there. You're exposed. Your location is exposed. Is this a new level, if you like?
It's not hugely new. No, there have been geolocation apps like Foursquare and Gowalla for a while now.
But obviously Facebook has about 500 million users, so it takes things to a new degree.
It does. When you've got that many users, then scaling actually changes the nature of the whole beast, because suddenly you can also aggregate a lot of information about a lot of different users and start to see patterns in that large user group that wouldn't be visible in a smaller applications user group.
And beyond privacy, the implications for advertising, marketing seem to be bigger.
Huge implications in terms of you'd be able to get more targeted advertising and marketing that is relevant to the location that you're at. So, for example, businesses would be able to give you offers redeemable on site, knowing that you are actually already there. And that's a lot more of a useful type of marketing than we've seen currently in the mobile space. But this isn't, again, it's not a massively new idea, because this was the sort of thing that was talked about when Bluetooth first arrived on the scene. Now, we were going to see then a lot more businesses providing location-specific marketing.
It's a progression, a natural progression, you'd say.
It is. It is a progression. But I think we do need to make sure that we're very aware of the implications of sharing our location online and make sure that it is just our trusted friends who have access to that data.
Okay. Sue Charman-Anderson, social media consultant on Facebook Places. Thank you very much. Now, back to our top story. The emergency meeting of the UN General Assembly still taking place. It's putting the spotlight on more than 20 million Pakistani flood victims and urging governments and people around the world to donate more money and to help. Well, Pakistan's Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi said that there is more than just disaster relief at stake.
The massive upheaval caused by the floods and the economic losses suffered by the millions of Pakistanis must be addressed urgently. If we fail, it could undermine the hard-won gains made by the government in our difficult and painful war against terrorism.
And the US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told the General Assembly that the United States is standing with Pakistan.
We know we face a humanitarian disaster of monumental proportions, and it is creating economic and security problems. And here at the United Nations, we often speak of a desire to forge a more humane fellowship with humankind. And today we must match that aspiration with action.
Hillary Clinton there. Well, we will be continuing to cover the situation on the ground in Pakistan and the international efforts to help the victims of the floods here on the BBC World Service. But for the moment, from me and the rest of the NewsHour team, goodbye for now.